Can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. My name is Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God and the program, People and Principles, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Good Standing in the Floating Big Book Group from the Hitting Bottom, capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. And my sobriety birthday is Halloween 1978. I'd like to thank the committee for the hospitality I've received this weekend, the privilege and honor to come down here and share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the experience of my sobriety and my learning to live with a disease called alcoholism, that you guys have taught me that. And it's a privilege to come down here and share that with you. I'd like to congratulate Dave on his recent marriage. It's a good deal. They're no longer living in sin. I don't know why I say crap like that. It just comes out of me, you know. This has been a great weekend so far. I really enjoyed Irene last night, and I really liked that panel, the old timers panel. I was really impressed with that. Some incredible messages and the great sense of humor, and it was. I've been to a lot of these old-timer panels around the country. This was the humblest old-timer panel ever. Sometimes it's like 2.5, 3 hours. They were like an hour. I mean, I've been to some conventions where you think you're at an on-and-on-and-on meeting, you know. This was a great deal. And I enjoyed every person that spoke. It was a great meeting. I know that there's some new people here, and I want to welcome you. I'm real glad you're here. I hope from the bottom of my heart that you will experience something or see something or hear something this weekend that will bring you back to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a hunger for what we have here. I was a newcomer for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to my first meeting as a young kid in an institution. I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink yet. In 1971. And from 1971 to 1978, I was in and out of the rooms of AA, and I was one of those kind of guys that I could understand what you were telling me intellectually, but I couldn't get it at the place they talk about in Chapter 3. We fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. I couldn't get it down there. Until I finally, in 1978, lost the one thing that stood between me and getting what you guys had here. And it was that little piece of self-reliance and judgment in me that always kept me separate from you. And I finally was lucky, and if you're new, I hope, with everything in me, that you're finally at a place in your life where you got to the point where you know the most important thing you will ever know, and that is that you don't know. And I finally got to that point in 1978. I got to the point where I was teachable. There's an old Buddhist proverb about that, and it talks about a farmer who lives on this little piece of ground with his only son, and they rest a meager living off the soil, and he has one possession. It's a horse. His whole property involves this horse. And one day, this wise little old man's horse runs off, and his neighbors and friends come over to console him. This is terrible. This is awful. You've lost your estate. And the little old man just shrugged his shoulders and says, I don't know if it's awful. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. They looked at him askance, like, how can you say that? And he just kept saying that. I don't know. A couple days later, that horse comes back, and it's leading a whole herd of wild horses, and they come over to congratulate him. My God, you're the richest man in the valley. This is incredible. This is a great thing. And the little old man just shrugged his shoulders and said, I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. They looked at him like he's crazy. What do you mean, maybe it is, maybe it isn't? You're the richest man in the valley. A couple days later, his only son's trying to break one of the wild horses, and he is thrown, and he's mangled and crippled, and he can't walk. And his friends and neighbors came over to console him and say, this is terrible. Your only son is now crippled and he can't work. Little old man just shrugged his shoulders and says, I don't know if it's awful. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. And they thought to themselves, how cold, your only son's crippled and you don't even take a position on this. And a few days later, the army came through that valley to take off all the young men to fight in a battle where none of them would survive. And the little old man knew the most important thing he'd ever know is that he doesn't know. In 1978, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally got to that point where I didn't know. And Dr. Tebow in AA Comes of Age talks about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And I was fortunate enough, once I got to that place where I was teachable, to have fallen into the hands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous that were really entrenched in this program, that believed in the principles and actions that are outlined in this book. They didn't believe in reparenting my inner child or any of that other kind of crap. They believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so fortunate because I had a small window of opportunity, because there came a time later when my alcoholic ego started to take charge. And if I wouldn't have been grounded in the disciplines and actions of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, I probably wouldn't be here and you'd have a different speaker tonight. My greatest problem is that I go on a run and alcohol takes everything away from me. I get dried out, end up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I get back is my opinion. And it is my opinion and my judgment that stand in the way of me getting everything that you have to offer. And I'm one of those kind of guys that, I didn't understand this for a long time. If you take alcohol away from me and you put me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I become very uncomfortable. I don't know that I'm afraid of people. I don't know that I have these tremendous feelings of inferiority. I don't know that because I'm insecure, my defense mechanisms are to judge you and keep me separate. I don't understand that. All I know is that I'm sitting in the middle of a group of people that I don't really like too well. And I'm one of those kind of guys that's sober. I quit drinking, I don't like to be around a lot of friendly, enthusiastic people. I mean, that's not, I just don't like that. You make me crazy. I mean, you seem to me like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that spoke was more grateful than the person who spoke before them. I mean, it was, you know, I'm just so happy. And I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting in the back of the room on my throne of contempt, judging everyone, and I'm not happy about anything. I'm what the big book talks about in the doctor's opinion. When Dr. Silkworth says that guys like me, when I quit drinking, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Abstinence to me feels like I'm doing time. And you put me in that condition in a group full of people that, and they all love me. You don't even know me, and if you did, trust me, you wouldn't even like me. And I don't like being around. I don't like being in AA, but I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. It's just that for some reason, every time I drink, I keep ending up where all the alcoholics are at. I don't know why that is. And here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous again and again and again and again, and it's the same deal, and I don't understand what's wrong with me. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in chapter 3, it says that most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, we try to prove ourselves exceptions to the rule. And that's exactly what I did. I didn't know that I was doing that. I just sat in meetings and compared the way what you guys said to what I was all about, and I just came up different. And one of the things that I came up different is, first of all, I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous as a young kid. And I came at a time when there weren't a lot of people that were that young in AA. And I'd sit in the rooms and I'd look around. And I mean, I could understand why you guys got quit drinking. There are people in AA, they're 30, 35 years old. Their life's over. I mean, right? But I'm a young kid, you know, and I'm hip, slick, and cool and all that other kind of stuff. And I use that to keep me separate, and I'm different. My case is special. And I also, I grew up in, I'm a real alcoholic, but I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s. And if you grew up as an alcoholic and you ran with the people I ran with at that time frame, I mean, we were, in addition to drinking a lot, we were also chemically well-balanced people. I mean, we did. And it's not that I'm not a real alcoholic. That's just part of the deal. And you didn't hear a lot about that back in those days. You didn't hear a lot of people talking about pills and other stuff. And I just used that I'm separate. I was the kind of guy that if you invited me over to your house, I'd ask to use your bathroom. And I'd go through your medicine cabinet. And I'd just take whatever was there. Sometimes I'd get wobbly and fall down. Other times I'd be up for days saying the same thing over and over again, chewing my tongue. Sometimes I just get real regular. I bet you I took enough of those wheels, there's no chance I'll be pregnant this century. And I used all of that I'm different and I'm separate and I'm not quite like you people. And you talked a lot about God. I had a problem. Whenever people talked about God in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd really get on the muscle. I could be listening to a speaker and identify with everything he said, and the minute he mentioned God, I discounted everything he said. It was like, oh, one of them. And I had a problem with that. I didn't understand until I was sober quite a few years what the problem was. I was raised in a real religious household. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from good church-going people that were real involved in the church, and there was a lot of talk of about spirituality there. And I went to Catholic school as a kid, and I was an altar boy and all that stuff. But there, I think that I had a propensity to alcoholism. When the book says we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, I think there was always something not quite right about me. I think my receiver was a little maladjusted as a little kid because I didn't hear about the God that my sister heard about. I didn't hear about the God that a lot of the kids in school heard about. I heard about a God that of judgment. And I think I have a propensity to look at a glass of water and I've always see it half empty rather than half full. And I just did that. And because I did that, this God of judgment just terrified me. First of all, he can see in the dark. That's not good for me. That's a bad deal for a guy like me. He can read my mind. The nuns, I hope this doesn't offend anybody. The nuns told me about this place for guys like me called purgatory. It's kind of like hell where they burn you and torture you. But in purgatory, it doesn't last forever. It only lasts for a couple hundred million years, right? And I get to be about 12, 13 years old, and I discover masturbation. And I could picture this meter in heaven clicking off the millions of years, you know. You know, and I haven't even done anything yet. I'm just practicing. So I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hear people talk about God, and I just get on the defensive. And that's another point of separation between me and you. And I want to talk about the last point because I think it's so devastating to most of us. I work with a lot of new guys. And the one thing that I have to get through is this last thing. There was something about me that I was convinced that I was different from you because I would stop drinking. And I would sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as sober as a judge. And it would become real apparent to me that whatever is wrong with me is not the same thing that is wrong with you because I have quit drinking and I don't feel like you look. I've quit drinking and it appears to me that everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous quits drinking, comes to AA, and just gets happy. Happy, happy, happy. I quit drinking, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I sit there and I feel so uncomfortable, and I don't know what's wrong with me, and I look around and I listen to the stories, and in Pennsylvania, in the meetings I used to go to in the years I was in and out, I would hear all these miracle stories about people who, they were living in a dumpster last week, and they came into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 6 months ago and found God, and now they're the president of United States Steel or something, you know? Right? And I'm not living on the streets because I'm in a halfway house, or other, I'm homeless. You know, you tell homeless alcoholics, ask them where they live. They don't live anywhere. Well, I'm staying over here. You know, and I'm sitting in the meeting and I'm comparing my insides and how I feel to the way you look outside, and I come to the conclusion that there's something else wrong with me. And what happens to me, and it happened to me for the years I was in and out, is that eventually I would become overwhelmed with the emptiness and the loneliness of my own untreated alcoholism. And I would get to a point where even after several rehabs, even after a lot of exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, even after getting to a point where I understand completely that to pick up a drink is to destroy myself, the emptiness of my own abstinence would drive me so insane that I would pick up something I know is going to destroy me, because I would feel backed into a corner, and I would feel that if I don't do something to change the way I feel, I'm going to lose my mind. And you know, the crazy part about that is that usually I got to that point when things were better than they'd ever been in my life. And it never made any sense to me. I could crawl out of the weeds or get out of the county jail and end up in a halfway house. And within 3 months, I got a job, a girlfriend, a car. I've got an apartment lined up. From the outside looking in, it looks like Bob's doing really good. But where I really live inside of me, I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. And I know what it's like if you're sitting here and you're sober several months or even several years. Believe me, I know what it's like to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of untreated alcoholism. There's not a lonelier, more separate or isolated or sick feeling than that. And I would do that until I couldn't stand it. I'd pick up a drink. And I'm the guy that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the book. I pick up a drink, I got that phenomenon of craving. I have had that phenomenon of craving since I took my first drink at 12 years old. I think I always had it. If I got to be 50 years sober and I take a drink, that phenomenon of craving waits for me. I am absolutely and totally convinced of that. I do a lot of work in hospitals and institutions, and I have watched people with 25, 35 years of sobriety who have drank. And I watch what happens to them. And I've watched people drink that emotionally they were doing real good. Their life was in real great shape when they picked up a drink. I had a member of my home group at 18 and a half years sober pick up a drink, and there was nothing wrong in his life. His life was better than it had ever been. The only thing that he wasn't doing is he was no longer working with newcomers. He'd gotten away from the steps, and he was only going to meetings to see his friends. And untreated alcoholism, in the midst of a beautiful life, drove him to drink. And he said, I asked him, I said, Paul, why'd you drink? He says, I don't know. He says, I was at the Rotary meeting. I go there once a week. I've been going for years. The waitress came along with one, asked me if I wanted a drink. The guy next to me ordered a cocktail. He's been ordering a cocktail for years at lunch. And I just said, I'll have one too. And he has had a hard time getting back. He gets 6 months and he goes out. And he gets out of the old story. Anyway, I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I'm living with untreated alcoholism, and I'm different and I'm separate. And I'm apart from, and I'm real uncomfortable. And I can't talk to anybody about what's going on with me, because I don't really know how to talk to anyone. I'm an isolationist. And I'm afraid to try to reach out to somebody because if I try to tell them things aren't doing well, they're going to ask me what's wrong. And the problem is that I don't have an answer to that question because nothing's really wrong. To live with untreated alcoholism is not so much that there's anything in particular wrong, it's that nothing is right. I feel like a fish out of water. And I'll tell you what happened in 1977. Myself and another guy that I was in a treatment program with, we went on a run, a long drunk. And one night we came back to his trailer. I was sleeping on the couch in his trailer, and he passed out. He left his car keys on the counter and his wallet. And I wasn't done drinking. I'm not done. I've never done drinking until I've passed out. I'm one of those kind of guys that I don't just stop drinking. I have never once in my life said, you know, I think I've had enough. I don't understand that. I mean, I've never been there. I have never said to a bartender, no, thank you. This is just right. I've never. I don't know that. I don't understand it. So I'm still conscious. So if I'm still conscious, I want to drink. So I borrowed his keys and his little bit of money, went out to get something to drink, and I don't remember it, but I got in a hit-and-run accident. I got arrested and charged with a felony DUI, hit-and-run, a stolen car. I was in the county jail for over 100 days because I was homeless and destitute, couldn't make bail. I went before a judge, and I was sentenced to 2 years in the state prison. And the judge did something that was very unusual. He stayed the commitment, and he told me that I could, if I would go into this one rehab, it was the only one left in that part of the country that would take me, I'd burn them all out. He says, you go into this one place, and you stay in there for a year. You come back before me in a year at this date, and we'll look at what you've done. And if you've made the restitution, you've gotten good UAs, good PO report, everything's kosher, you won't have to do the year. But if you don't fulfill any of those requirements, you're going up. It's done deal. So I enter into a state of abstinence. I'm in a state of abstinence, and I go into this place to live with all these other alcoholics that are all brand new in sobriety. Winter's coming on, and I was homeless, and I don't want to be out in the streets. I figured it's a blessing. At least I'm off the streets. I know what it's like to walk all night long in the wintertime because you can't sit down because it's 10 degrees out, and if you sit down, you fall asleep, so you got to walk all, look for doorways and stuff. And so I'm in this place, and I got two dramatic reasons why I don't want to drink. If I pick up a drink, I'm going to prison, and if I pick up a drink before I go to prison until they pick me up, I'm going to be out there living in the snow. So I went in there with a determination, and I got to tell you something, if determination and sincerity were enough to overcome alcoholism, I would have never drank from that point on. But I'm the guy they talk about in the book, lack of power is my dilemma. And I went into that place, and I hung on, and I didn't drink for several months. Made it through the winter, and spring's coming on, and I'm just getting antsy. I'm getting crazy. And I could, by this time, I'd been in and out so many times and I'd had so many relapses, I could tell when I'm getting ready to go. I could tell. I'm wound up. I'm ready. I'm cocked and ready. And I could tell because I become on the muscle around people. I'm real uptight and I get lonelier and more distant, and my head, it makes out everybody else to be a jerk, and I'm getting just nuts and crazy. And I'm at this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the place I'm living, and after the meeting, I grabbed this old-timer, and I said something to a person I'd never said before. I said, I need help. And I meant it with everything in me. I said, I really need help. I'm afraid I'm going to drink. And I started to tell this guy about, to the best of my capability, of how I felt and what was going on with me. I told him about my fear of doing the 2 years in prison. I told him about what was going on in my head. I had all these crazy thoughts all the time. I mean, I was like, I'd wake up in the morning sometimes and be dying of cancer in my head, you know. I could be sitting watching TV in the TV room and get a headache, and I could just feel a brain tumor growing. And then And then I would have all these voices in my head. You know the way you talk to yourself in your head? Well, they would get more accelerated, and they're always telling me stuff that's all, you know, what if, Bob? What if? What if? What if? And I'm just nuts. You know, you take alcohol away from me, and trying to live with my alcoholic mind in a state of untreated alcoholism is like driving cross-country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. You know, it's brutal. It's just brutal. And I'm telling him about the emotional problems that I have. I got emotional problems, and I thought maybe I need another therapist, but I'd been to so many of them and they never helped me. But something's wrong with me emotionally, because I can be on top of the world 1 minute, and then all of a sudden I just get so depressed and nobody's even said nothing to me. I just go on these roller coaster rides emotionally. And I'm just crazy. And I told him about that. And I told the guys about my trying to work. I can get a job. I can't keep a job. I don't fit well with people. And they're always saying things to me like, Bob, we're going to have to let you go. There's something wrong with your attitude. And it's like, what? What do you mean my attitude? I don't get it. Or they'd say things to me, Bob, you're just not a team player. Well, I don't know how to be a team player. You take alcohol out of my life and you put me to work with a bunch of guys somewhere, I don't fit nowhere. Now, you give me 5 shots of Jack Daniels, I'll fit with anybody anywhere. But sober, I don't fit nowhere. And so I get jobs and I can't hold them. I lose them. And I'm always the guy, and sometimes I try to blame them. It's always their fault. It's always their fault. But you do that for a few years and you start to realize it's not their fault. You know, it's got to be me. But I don't know how to change me. And I'm telling him all this, and I'm telling him, I'm going on and on, and I finally said, I need help. Tell me what to do. He said, on the wall of the room was a thing with the 12 steps, and he pointed to him, and he said, Bob, we have these 12 steps. If you'll do those, this stuff will change for you. And I sat there, and I'm desperate. And I thought to myself, well, my God, I've seen those steps. Maybe this time I better really read them. And I took a minute and I was reading those steps, and it became real apparent to me that what I just told him, he mustn't have heard any of it, because there's nothing in those steps that apply to anything I've just told him. Absolutely. There's not even, if you stretch your imagination, there's not even a connection. None. I mean, I need a set of steps like step one, make Bob's police record disappear, you know. Step two, get his family to realize how wrong they'd always been about him. Step three, bring her back properly ashamed of herself, you know. Step four, give him $5,000. I mean, that would have been a step that would have helped a guy like me. Or if he even had a step that said I would just feel better, be able to sleep without waking up in the middle of the night afraid of stuff. If he just would have had a step like that. Instead, we got, turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I could see how you guys could do that. You were nice people. I mean, I lived on the streets. I mean, I did some lousy stuff. I mean, I was the kind of guy that if you felt sorry for me and told me I could sleep on your couch when you went to work, I robbed you. You know, it wasn't personal. I mean, you know, I just did it, you know. I hurt a lot of people. There were some guys that went to prison as a result of my actions, because of my own self-centered fear. I did some things that caused them to go to prison. And I could see how you would have done that, but I did some things that are just unforgivable sins. I can't turn my will, my life over to the care of God. I'd rather turn it over to a narcotics agent. And then the making amends, I remember sitting and looking at the two steps on the amends and just feeling horrified. I can't do that. I just can't. I'd hurt everyone that ever came in contact with me. I could just picture myself going up to the head of this outlaw motorcycle gang that I dimed out to the police, and he had to go do 10 years in prison, and say, well, Cheech, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to tell you I'm sorry you had to do the 10 years. I mean, I'd rather put a gun to my head, you know? So I walked away from that guy and I shook my head, and I'll tell you what I knew. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was a great fellowship. and you even had some nice principles. And that if I ever got my life together, I might do those steps. Hey, I might join a gym too. I don't know. But I became convinced that there was nothing in those steps that is going to deal with anything that is wrong with me. And I walked away from the solution to all my problems. All my problems. I was handed the keys to the kingdom, and I threw them away because I had an opinion, and I had a judgment. And I still had the one thing that kept me from getting everything that you have, and that's my self-reliance. I still reserved the right to follow what made sense to me. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, the miracle of AA starts in that third step. My sponsor, when I was new, I was having a conversation with him, and we're talking about the third step, and I said, I don't think I can do a third step. I don't really know that there's a God. I don't know if I believe in God. And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, you don't have to believe in God. If you'll turn your will and your life over to that chair, I guarantee you an instant miracle. I said, okay. I turned my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? He says, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And you know something? He was right. Nobody could have systematically and effectively and as efficiently destroyed my life as I did. At the age of 12 years old, when I started drinking, and I came from a good family with a tremendous amount of opportunity, if I would have hired a group of college professors, the most brilliant people in the country, and said to them, you know, things are really going my way here. I want you guys to come up with a 10 or 15-year game plan that's going to screw me up so much that no one will talk to me and I'm going to be thinking about suicide. Could you come up with that? Really put your heads together. Use computers, anything you need. Come up with it. I'll tell you something. They couldn't have come up with a plan that would have been any more effective than the way I lived my life. And yet, I never once set out to break my mother's heart or make my dad so sick he had ulcers or make the women that loved me finally turn their back on me or make bosses have to let me go, or come to places so humiliated with myself that I wished I had the courage to kill myself. I never once set out to do any of that stuff, and yet I did it so effectively. And I guess that's why I cannot manage my own life. See, I don't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a self-help program. I think it's a program of self-abandonment. It's self-help implies that whoever's running the show, we're going to educate them so they can run it better. No, we're going to get him out of the driver's seat. And that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1978, I got sober and I got a sponsor, which I have till this day, and a home group, the Floating Big Book Group, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you the reason I got that group is that they were the only group in Southern Nevada that did hospital and institution work, and they did it on a regular basis, and they were the people who brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous into the hospital I was in the last time. And they were the people that showed up there and gave me rides to meetings and reached out to me. And I feel so privileged to be a part of a group that is real to this day, real active in H&I work in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group puts on 10 hospital and institution meetings every week. And I have the privilege this year to secretary 3 of those meetings. If you're ever in Las Vegas on a Monday night, I do a 12-step workshop in a men's Skid Row men's halfway house, Tuesday and Thursday at noon at a Skid Row detox, the place that will take you if you don't have insurance or anything else. And I'm so privileged to show up and to give them the most important thing I got, my time, to those guys. Because the people did that for me in 1978. And the guys that I sponsor, I encourage them to do it. And we run in a pack. We go from these places in like a pack of guys. We select the big book stormtroopers, you know. And I watch guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that I sponsor come alive with the program of AA as a result of not hearing profundities in meetings as a result of trying to give it to somebody else. And that's where I really see the lights come on. And it's a beautiful thing. And in my members of my home group and my sponsor started to have me take actions that I didn't even really believe in. They told me I had to hit my knees, get down physically on my knees in the morning and ask whatever's running the universe for help. And I did it not because I believed in God. I did it because I believed in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'd been living it. I did it because I was finally beaten into a state of reasonableness that I think I would have done anything you told me to do. And thank God I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I ended up in the Hare Krishnas. I might be in some airport today with a starter rope coming out the back of my head, chanting. And I started taking this actions. I started sticking my hand out to new people and praying every day and acting as if the same power that you say is working in your life is working in mine. Now, I didn't believe it was working, but I started taking the action. And the most amazing things started happening to me. I can't tell you the endless series of coincidences that happened to me my first several years. Happened to me to this day in sobriety. Just the first couple years, they were so overwhelming. I felt like I was in the twilight zone. You know, every time I needed something, it would just be there. I'd be jammed up sitting in my apartment and it'd be just crazy. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what I'm feeling or what's going on. And I would ask God for help and go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there'd be some stranger in the room talking about what's going on with me in a way that I can understand it. And that happened to me over and over and over and over again. When I was a little over a year sober, I got my first, I found her. You probably don't do that out here. We do that back out west. We find her. And I was my first love affair. And when it was over and she went off with some other guy, I got nothing left. And I'm working at this time. I have this little job as a cashier in a store that sells alcohol. And it's a Sunday afternoon, it's slow. My sponsor's out of town. And I'm in that store alone with me in my head. And it became so clear to me that what I need to do is take a case of vodka, stick it in the trunk of my car, go out in the desert and get some relief. And the minute I thought that, I became terrified because I don't ever want to sober up again. And I went in the back room of that liquor store and I got down on my knees and I, with tears in my eyes, I begged God for help. 10 minutes later, a woman who was sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous came walking through the front door of that liquor store and she told me the most incredible story before I got to tell her what was going on with me. She says, I went to go see this movie and I got held up in traffic. And I got there and it already started and I had another almost hour and a half to kill before it starts again. And she said, just about 10 minutes ago, the thought came into my mind, didn't that Bob from our group take a job at some liquor store? There's one not too far from here. I got nothing to do. I'll drive up there and just see if he's there. Now later I figured out she must have got that thought at the exact same instant I'm in the back room begging God for help. And when you have things like that happen to you over and over and over again, I started to come to believe that I had tapped into something here that I could not, even the skeptic that I am, cannot dispute. It's like over in London, around the turn of the century, the streets of London were lit by gas lamps. And there was a man who, they called him a lamplighter, and every day at dusk, his job was to walk up and down the streets of London with a long pole with a flame on the end, lighting the gas lamps. And at twilight, you could climb up to the top of the Tower of London and look out over the city, and no matter how hard you looked, you could not see where the lamplighter was. But you could see where he'd been. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at two and a half, three years sober, and I couldn't see where God was. But let me tell you, with everything in my experience, I could see where he'd been. Not only in my own life, but I could see the guys that came out of Samaritan House and Starting Point and the Skid Row Detox 6 months after me that were homeless, that had absolutely nothing going on. They were dead in the eyes. And now they got their They're sponsoring people, and they're on panels, and they're secretary in meetings, and the light's on. And they have a vitality and a love of life that would be absolutely incapable for them to ever achieve by any therapeutic method. That you watch that enough, you must believe that something is transforming these people. Because I could see it in you way before I could see it in me. It's hard for me to see it in me. It's kind of like standing in front of the mirror trying to watch your hair grow. You don't get it. But I could see it in you. And I started a love affair with a power greater than myself. And I talked to him several times every day. It's just a part of my life. Just a part of my life. And I came here an atheist. I came here a militant atheist. I belong to a group that's real involved in service, and my sponsor pushed me from the very beginning to go on 12-step calls and to go to the hospitals and institutions and do all that stuff. And I'm a slow study. I tell you, I didn't get it. I don't understand why I'm doing this for a long time. I don't understand what's going on. It seemed to me that I really should be working on my problems instead of trying to help these people that aren't ever going to stay sober anyway. And I used to go to my sponsor and I'd ask him all these questions, and he just kept telling me the same thing. Just keep going, keep saying that third step prayer, keep talking to God, trying to help other people. And one night when I was a couple, probably two or two and a half, I don't know, my first few years of sobriety, I'm sitting home one night and I just came from a meeting and I'm depressed. And I came from an early meeting and I'm sitting in there and I hadn't heard anything in the meeting, and I'm in one of those spots where I'm pondering my life. And it seems like the more I ponder my life, the more I'm like sinking into this abyss, you know. The more I think about it, that job that I told them how great it was in meetings, I start realizing how it's not that good of a job and they're taking advantage of me. And I start the people in AA that say are my friends, the more I think about it, that's just the AA thing to do. They probably don't really like me. And, you know, I'm just going into this pit. And everybody, I'm sponsoring guys that have better jobs than I do. And, you know, and it's just, I'm sinking this pit. And I don't know what to do. And it's about 10 o'clock at night. And there's a 10:15 meeting not too far from my apartment. And so I asked God for help. I get up. I was so depressed, I had to physically force myself off the sofa. It was almost as if the depression had its own inertia. And I physically forced myself off the sofa, got in the car, went to the meeting, sat in the back of the room. I didn't hear nothing. I'm so in here. I'm so wrapped up in myself. What you're saying in the meeting is like Muzak in a doctor's office. I don't even hear it. But in the back of the room, across the room from where I'm sitting, is a guy that I had seen in Alcoholics Anonymous before who's coming off a drunk. And he's sitting there and he's rocking. He's grabbing himself like this and he's rocking back and forth like he's going to fly apart. And then he gets up and he paces back and forth. I mean, he's just really annoying me. He's just, I'm trying to figure my life out, and this good clown's over here doing this dance. And then he goes in the bathroom. He's in there dry heaving, and I'm thinking, boy, the caliber of the meetings around here sure has fallen significantly lately, you know. And I'm the meeting's over, and I want to get home. I want to go home quick and get there so I can think. But I've been trained like Pavlov's dog to do service in AA, so I'm helping this guy, Charlie P., set the chairs up in the church again for the services and next day and do everything we do, you know. And we're picking up the cups, and him and I are the last two guys to leave, and we're standing on the front door of the church, and he's locking up. My car is right there. And the guy that was in the back of the meeting that was sick is curled up in a fetal position and right in front of my car. I'm going to have to step over him to get into my car to go home and think. But I can't do that because Charlie's standing there. And if I do that, he's going to tell everybody in AA what a bad member of Alcoholics Anonymous I am if I just ignore this guy that's laying there. So I go over, I kneel down, I start talking to him, and he's a mess. I mean, he's just, he's gone to the bathroom on himself, and he's just, he's shaking, and he wants to commit suicide, and he's sick, and he's scared he's going to go into DTs. And at this time in Las Vegas, there was no detox center that was available to alcoholics if you didn't have insurance or money. There was a period of about 3 years that we just either took them into our homes or we had to if they were real sick like this guy, you had to take them down to the county hospital. And I used to do this all the time. I hated it because they would make you wait sometimes 8 hours in the emergency room to get a guy in. And I thought to myself, I put the guy in my car and we're going down to the county hospital. And I'm not saying anything to him, but in my head, I'm bitching and whining and complaining. How come I got to do this? Am I the only one in Alcoholics Anonymous that does anything around here? You know, I feel inconvenienced and put upon. And I go down there and I'm sitting in this waiting room with this sick guy, and he's a mess. I'm giving him orange juice and cigarettes, and he's telling me about himself, and I'm listening. And he's telling me about how ashamed of himself he is for the things he did to his mom and his dad. Boy, and I can remember that shame because I did the same thing. He's talking to me. He's telling me about how he hates himself for not having the courage to kill himself. And I remembered standing on a bridge in Pittsburgh looking down at railroad tracks and sobbing because I didn't have the courage to jump off and do the right thing. He's telling me about all the failures in his life and how he hates himself and how scared he is and how ashamed of himself he is. And I sat there with him for several hours, and they finally took him in there. And I remember driving home, and I remember crying in my car. And there were tears of gratitude because I finally got it. I'd been asking God on my knees every morning for a long time to relieve me of the bondage of self, and he keeps doing it with situations and people like this. And I finally understood, because I'll tell you something, driving away from that hospital, I felt more complete, more whole, more right about myself, my life, and the universe I live in than I ever probably had in my whole life. Even more complete and more whole than I did when I was 17 or 18 years old and alcohol worked at its very best. And it gave me that sense that I fit. See, I am one who believes that alcohol was the most immediate and effective treatment for alcoholism I will ever experience. And I'll say this, and this will sound like heresy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but if God would walk in this room right now and say, Bob, I'm going to give you 2 more years of drinking like when you were 17, there would be a breeze as I shot out the door. I didn't get sober because it was the right thing to do. I got sober because alcohol stopped working for me. Now, when I say that, don't get me wrong. It's not that I couldn't get drunk. It's not that I couldn't drink to pass out. I could do all that stuff. But as far as a treatment for the inside emptiness and the disease of separation that I experienced, as far as the treatment for that, it didn't work anymore. At the end of my drinking, if I walked into a party, 5 shots of whiskey or a couple drinks didn't make me feel like I was connected and part of, and I could talk to people and laugh and meet girls and stuff. At the end of my drinking, I was the guy that was drinking himself into oblivion, looking at everybody else having a good time. Alcohol stopped reducing the state of separation in me, and I lived in a loneliness that the best I could do was numb. The best. And the best relief I could get was to pass out or blackout. And I found in Alcoholics Anonymous the same thing, only it's a very slow process. When I started trusting in God and the members of my home group and my sponsor and acting as if and taking the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing I did is I stopped hurting myself. I started taking alternative actions that were against my feelings. And I had a sponsor that just was relentless when it came to the eighth and ninth step. He would not let me get out of anything. And he told me, he says, after listening to your fifth step, he says, you're one of the kind of guys that's probably going to help people the rest of your life and not be even. And he said also, he says, you're going to probably have to spend the rest of your life look with your eyes and your ears open in case God puts somebody from your in your past. Because I hurt a lot of people. I don't know where they are. And if there's anybody in this room, please come up to me. I got my checkbook with me. Just see me after the meeting. And that may happen. So I don't. There's a lot of people I hurt over the years that I don't know who they are. I don't know where they live. They were just nameless, faceless people. Houses I burglared, cars I broke into, purses I snatched, guys I ripped off on the streets, that I may have to spend the rest of my life with my eyes and my ears open, waiting to see if God puts somebody like that in my path again, and that it's my job to be ready to make it right. It's like there's an old story around Alcoholics Anonymous about an old-timer, guy's sober 25, 30 years, and he's sitting in a park one day on a park bench. And across the path, there's another park bench, and sitting on that bench is a punk rocker. And the guy's got a cone of blue hair that comes out like this, and a cone of hot pink hair, cone of yellow hair, and a cone of orange hair. And the old guy in AA is looking at him, and the punk rocker jumps up and runs over and starts screaming at the old man, what are you looking at, old man? You got a problem with the way I look? And the old guy says, no, son, no. You see, I used to be bad to drink. And one night when I was really drunk, I made love to a parrot, and I thought maybe you might be my son. So you got to keep your eyes and ears open. You never know. And I just got to make an amends 6-7 months ago that was 25 years outstanding. And a friend of mine, Billy, who's I hang around with, we do a lot of 12-step work together. We got to go to Pennsylvania to participate in an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. And in my early sobriety, I went back there to try to make amends to a lot of people I owed amends to, and I made all the ones I could find. And there was a gal that I had been involved with that I'd hurt her pretty badly, and I'd never could find her. I looked in the phone book, I talked to people, nobody knew where she was. And just a couple months ago, we're back there, and I'm sitting in this hotel room, and just the thought just came to me, look in the phone book. And I opened the phone book, and there she was. She'd gotten a divorce, went back to her maiden name, and moved back to that town again. And I called her up, and I'll tell you something, God has perfect, perfect timing. He is the most incredible choreographer. I called her up, according to my way of thinking, 15 to 18 years later than I planned on, finally to make this amends. And she took it real well, and we started to become friends. And she calls me and writes me notes, and I call her, and we started to become close friends. And her and her new husband, or I don't know if they're married, the guy she lives with have a friend that I grew up with that I haven't seen in 30 years. And he's a real bad alcoholic. And she'd never met anybody that was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to tell her about my experience. And just a couple weeks ago, she called me up and she told me that this guy, Jim, went to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if I'd have made that amends when I wanted to make it back in 1980, that Jim had never gotten brought to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to remind myself constantly that I'm no longer running the show. Because the dangerous thing for me is that I get all these judgments and opinions about how things should go, and I got to constantly remind myself, I don't know. I really don't know. It may seem this way to me, but I don't have all the information. I'm going to share one more experience, and I'm going to quit. About a little over 2 years ago, my mom died. And she died a horrible, horrible death. Emphysema and lung cancer at the same time. My mom and I had become very close. She lived right near my office, and I would go over every day and spend time with her. And she died at home. Took her a long time, months. And I would go over there every day, and I would sit with her, and I'd hold her hand, and I would tell her all the things that just would come to me. My sponsor told me, he says, you're going to have things come to you, and you got to say them. And I found out, I thought I'd made amends to my mother. I hadn't even touched it. And I got to get into some things with her and do some things that I never even would have considered. I sat there and took care of her. And while I'm taking care of her, I got to thank her for the times when I was a little kid when I was sick and she took care of me. I got to tell her over and over again how grateful I am that she was my mother. I got to walk her right up to the edge and watch her go home. And I sat with her the last 23 and a half hours until she took her last breaths. And I encouraged her. I said, Mom, let go. It's time to go. Dad's waiting for you, Mom. It's time to go. And she couldn't talk anymore. She just nodded her head. And I walked her up to the door. And I miss her. I miss her still to this day, and it's been a couple years. Right after she died, my sister and myself were the only people surviving. And my sister had lost her mother, and I'd lost mine. We were now orphans. We both lost our father a couple years earlier. And my mom left a moderate estate of stocks and bonds and mutual funds, etc. And they were in a safety deposit box. And she had a will, and the will spelled out that my sister and I were to split everything. And I'm at my office about a day or two after my mom died. My sister comes into the office, and she said she had all this stuff with her. And she handed me an envelope. It had like $300 in it of old bills. And she said, Mom wanted you to have this, and she told me at the end she wanted me to have everything else. And I said, really? Because I had spent a lot of time with her, and I never, didn't seem that way to me. But I never said nothing, and I talked to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, some of my spiritual advisors, and they just said, wait, don't do nothing. And I had other people in AA say, get a lawyer, man, don't let her do that to you, this is not right, and etc. And I searched inside myself, and I talked to these people, and I said, no, man, either God is everything or he's nothing. And my sponsor told me over and over and over and over again in early sobriety that money will never be your problem. Your problem is alcoholism, self-centered fear, and a bad attitude. And I had to remind myself who was running the show, my sister would say this, she wants to take it all, and I just say, well, if that's what you think's right. And I never fought her about it. I just went along with whatever she said. And it came to pass that to cash in the bonds, mutual funds, etc., all those companies wanted a copy of a certified copy of the will. And when they got the certified copy of the will, they automatically sent me half. And I started getting the checks, and I called up my sister. I said, Marge, I'm getting these checks. What do you want me to do? And you know what she said? She said, well, she says, maybe I was wrong. Maybe Mom really did want you to have half. Now, I stood at a turning point when she came into my office. I could have said, you can't do, I could have stood up for my rights. I could have said, you can't do that to me, and I'm going to fight you. And I would have lost my only surviving relative. And I'll tell you something else. A couple months ago, my sister started going through a really bad divorce. And I'm all she has left. I'm the person she called. I sponsored her ex-husband for 13 years, and now he's out there. And I'm the guy she gets to call, and I get to be there for her. And isn't that really what this is all about? It's not about getting more. It's about being there for God's kids. It's been ingrained in me that there's a spiritual principle here that God will take care of me in direct proportion to how I help his kids. That I never have to want for anything. If I just show up and I try to be of service and I show up as a servant, that God will shower me with abundance and richness and absolutely everything I ever need. And that has been my experience for the last over 19 years. I live a tremendous lifestyle. I found something, the more service I do in AA, the richer my life becomes. And the richer my life becomes, the more of the truth I know. And the truth is, this is the truth. I don't deserve the life I have, really. Not really. I mean, you can argue that philosophically, well, yeah, you're God's kid and all that. I know what I am. I know where I came from. I don't deserve the life I got. So because I don't deserve it, I owe. Because I owe, I got to do more service. And I do more service, and my life gets better. Now I owe more. I mean, it's like God's the worst loan shark in the universe, you know? I'm never going to get out of this thing alive. There's a guy that I sponsor. I'm a, I got about 2 minutes. I'm going to share this and I'm going to shut up. I met this guy at Detox 19 months ago. And he came up to me and he said, the people in the detox are pressuring me to go into this long-term therapeutic community because I'm homeless and I've had so many problems. I said to him, you ever been in one of those before? He said, I've been in 3 of them. Didn't do you much good, did they? He said, no. He says, what should I do? And I was in a weird mood that way. And sometimes God uses my own defects of character to help people. I'm in one of those kind of sarcastic moods. I'm kind of in my hurry. I'm in a hurry to get back to work. I said, I think you should go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every day, get a sponsor, work the steps. I think you should do that even if you got to live in the weeds. And I walked away. The guy got out of detox and he made himself a little camp in the weeds. Honest to God. And he was going to 2 and 3 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a day. He started working the steps. He started doing service in AA. He started going back in there helping people. And his life just transformed. And when he was in detox, I heard him say something that I'll never forget. He said to me, I'm suggesting he should go to AA. And he said, I've been to AA. He says, it's kind of like a cross between school, church, and the country club. And you know something? I've never really fit in any of those. And he just hung his head. And when he did that, I fell in love with him. Because I knew exactly what he was talking about. Because I remember walking into Alcoholics Anonymous with that feeling of, it's all of you enjoying life, and then there's me. And I got to watch my friend Bob, and as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, come alive and become on fire with the program Alcoholics Anonymous. He sponsors about 5 or 6 guys now, and he's not even sober 2 years. I'm going to read this and close. It's page 100 of the big book. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances may be. Thank you very much.
Thank you.